From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Natural, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and games development.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
I'm Ian Peters, and I make nice games.
And I'm Lydia Simchich, and I, too, make nice games. Mark's on a boat, so we're going to talk about something he doesn't want to talk about, tabletop RPGs. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
Well, Mark, super nerd that he is on a Star Trek cruise. So
it's a Star Trek. I did not realize it was Star Trek.
Yeah. It's a whole, this is going to be a bunch of actors in Star Trek, a bunch of people who worked on the production.
Cool.
Mark was really excited to talk to, I don't remember the specific facts, but there was somebody who's like, who did like the art for things.
Oh, it was the art for the Artemis expedition from NASA.
Yes.
Who they also did something from Star Trek.
Did important stuff. It's important work in Star Trek, and I'm not Mark, so I don't remember
cool.
all
okay,
the facts.
Gonna, he's just rolling over, he's, upset at us for not remembering
I
how
know.
Cool it is.
He's experiencing seasickness.
This is probably the least Star Trek that the show has ever been, which is wild.
And so I also have wanted to have Ian on the show for a while.
Mm-hmm.
There have been times where, despite me being a professional game dev, Ian has been doing more game design than I have on a daily basis.
Oh.
And at one point, Ian said, I want to get on the show and talk about D&D. So guess what?
We're here now.
That's what we're doing.
This is my beautiful husband.
Hello. You can't see my face. This is an audio podcast, but my name's Ian.
Uh-huh.
I'm Lydia's husband. I am here to talk about D&D. I've been DMing a campaign. Well, we just finished a campaign that mm-hmm. lasted for about 2.5 years, but I've been DMing for about 5 years now, and I've got a lot of thoughts about tabletop
yeah,
games.
Yeah, and Steven, you started playing D&D.
Yes.
And you've also just started playing another session
well,
of D&D?
Well, we did a session zero thingy, so we haven't, like, officially started playing it yet, but yeah we're working towards the new one, so I don't know what happened. I tend to stumble upon these things.
Hey,
well, this one I guess is a long time coming because it's with the same people who I played Baldur's Gate 3 with.
Oh yeah.
So
that's good. How are you finding the difference between Baldur's Gate rules and D&D rules?
Because
there are slight tweaks.
I found Baldur's Gate 3 to be very confusing.
Okay.
And I find D&D less confusing because I
really?
Dealt with that struggles in Baldur's Gate 3.
I
imagine if I had just done D&D, I would have no idea what I was doing because it was very difficult for me to understand Baldur's Gate 3.
Interesting. That's a fully different topic, I guess. But the differences between Baldur's Gate 3 and D&D 5th edition are small but significant.
Yeah, I've heard from the people who I play a lot.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. There are cases of people who start playing D&D after loving Baldur's Gate 3 and finding that, you know, the most common thing that comes up is you get advantage on some rolls when you have high ground in Baldur's Gate 3, and that's not a mechanic.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's not a real mechanic in D&D.
That seems weird.
I know.
Huh. I know. It's logical enough that you always think that it's part of the rules of the universe, and it is not a rule
in 5th edition.
D&D 5e.
Yeah.
Huh.
It might be a thing in older editions that I'm not familiar with, but it is not a thing in 5th edition.
Yeah, there's things about cover in D&D, but I don't think they have things about high ground.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Right?
Well, we wanted to talk about tabletop RPGs from a developer perspective. I think we kind of wanted to split this up into three different parts. We'll see how well that goes.
Yeah, it's like Baldur's Gate. It is in three acts.
Yeah.
And no one ever gets out of act one.
Yeah.
True. So I think our first topic is the holistic connection of theme and mechanics. What does that mean?
Yeah, so this is about... This is a thing in video game design, too, where there's a way to design for a specific genre,
yeah.
I think. With D&D, and I should just say up top, D&D is Dungeons & Dragons, 5e is 5th edition. Mm. There have been five significant publications of D&D going back to like the 1970s, essentially. D&D 5e is the most popular D&D has ever been, and as such, it's often the game that people first learn when they come to tabletop now.
As lovers of podcasts, as I assume you all are, if you've ever heard of The Adventure Zone, if you've ever heard of Dungeons and Daddies, not a BDSM podcast, which I've mentioned on the podcast before, if you've heard of Worlds Beyond Number, all of those play D&D 5e.
Yeah. It is at its core a fantasy genre system. But because so many people learn D&D and love it, they will also try to take these other genres of things that they love because they've watched heist movies or crime series and they've played something like Dishonored or so they will try to make a heist campaign or they'll try to make a horror campaign when there are other games designed well for heists and horror, and they try to shoehorn them into D&D because it's the game that they're familiar with and comfortable with, and it kind of works. You can do it, but I think people tend to have a better time if they actually make the effort to go and learn one of those other systems that isn't for fantasy.
Yeah, yeah.
So when we talk about games pairing with theme in the context of like video games, one of the first thing that I think of, for example, is how like a lot of horror games, you don't have the ability to fight. And that is part of what makes it scary. Like in Amnesia, you can't fight the monsters. You can only run away. You can only sneak. And that is a very core element that makes them so terrifying. You have other core mechanics that are part of, you know, the core theme or the core verbs of that genre. That, you know, I think that's where a lot of that is representative in video games.
What I oftentimes have a difficult time with respect to like how video games do the different themes and mechanics is that like sometimes you can feel when a game implemented something because like other games have done it.
Yeah.
Not necessarily things that like make sense for that game in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel like you can definitely feel that distinction in like a tabletop RPG if you were like to put D&D mechanics into like a heist thing, like you were saying.
Yeah, it's the fishing minigame in every RPG.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't say fishing minigames around Steven.
Well, I know you had a whole episode about fishing. Well, there was at least one section of one episode that was dedicated to it.
It's a whole thing and it's still a thing, but it's fine. But Mark's not here, so.
Oh, that's true.
No pressure.
I will say though that with D&D, it's kind of it seems fickle in a way where with a TTRPG you have a live GM with live people. D&D seems like it should be easier to quote unquote shoehorn or to adapt in that way because you're not going against a computer. You have a live person who is your GM. You have live people that you're working with, and so when it comes to having a lot of rules, you don't necessarily have to. It seems like you could be more flexible in that way and be able to adapt more easily because you're not having to hard code into a computer that then has to only understands ones and zeros.
Yeah. I'm not saying that you can't do other genres in D&D. I just think that there are other games suited better for it. I think The Adventure Zone, which is the podcast that Lydia and I first listened to start being exposed to D&D, this was probably back in 2018, 2019, thereabouts.
Mm-hmm.
Their first campaign, which was also those folks' first time playing D&D.
Yeah, okay.
Their first campaign goes through these sort of 7 arcs, and a lot of them are deliberately like 6 episode genre, like it's a vignette basically.
Sure.
And or like an anthology is maybe a better word.
Yeah.
The second or third arc is specifically a like closed box mystery because it's a murder on a train.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't leave the train, so you got to figure out the murder.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think mystery is a genre that D&D can do pretty well, honestly. But then so frequently they'll try to shoehorn like a horror campaign into it. But because D&D is so designed for dungeon crawling, you're fighting a bunch of monsters in a haunted house, even though, like what Lydia said earlier, oftentimes in horror, you can't fight back.
Yeah.
Or it's very limited.
Yeah. You then have to pull, in order for it to go off correctly, you have to pull other things from your toolkit. Like you have to have to pull in your skills to narratively frame the scene and to evoke the emotions and the direness of it.
Yeah.
And you have to play also with how much information you give, what kind of information. But that's different than it being mechanically designed for to create that sensation.
Right. In order for that to make sense, you have to add your own, you have to bring something new to the table.
Yeah.
Literally, I guess. And that's one of the things that I have a hard time with with respect to D&D is that, like, it feels so combat focused.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas, like, they give you a ton of, like, different spells and stuff. But, like, the spells you get, the ones that don't do anything in combat feel more... They don't feel defined well enough for me to feel like I can really grasp how to use them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, Fireball, you know exactly what that does. Yeah. It gives you all the details.
Exactly.
I also have an issue, but I think from the opposite side,
sure.
where I'm very creative with tools that I'm given.
Yeah.
However, when I am, like, one of the I first played a Grave Cleric, and clerics, you can change your entire spell loadout every night or every long rest.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's my new character.
It's important to know.
That's okay. Why I said it's good that you're playing a cleric second and not first.
Yeah. Okay.
And so for me, I have problems with decision paralysis in general. And so trying to anticipate, well, what am I going to need tomorrow? Oftentimes, like, I want to incorporate a lot of those more, I almost said soft skills, but more of those creative tools as opposed to combat tool type spells. And when you have limited resources, both spell slots and, you know, number of prepared spells, it gets harder for me to feel like I can justify it. And I want to take the fun ones to use creatively and perhaps effectively.
Right.
But is the risk too high for me to do that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do I just need to get Fireball because I really need to do a lot of damage because who knows what's going to be in that house, you know?
Right.
I think that is honestly kind of a nice segue to talking about Blades in the Dark and the concept of load in that game specifically.
Okay.
So Blades in the Dark is a heist game primarily.
Sure.
It's the next campaign that I'm going to run with my in-person group is going to be a Blades in the Dark game.
Okay.
And we'll talk about it a little bit more later as well when it comes to how to roll dice in that game. But the whole sort of synopsis of it is when you're doing a heist, players tend to get really bogged down in the details. They're planning and planning and planning, and then the session is 4 hours over and you don't actually get to the heist because everyone needs to go to bed.
Or we end up planning on something we think is important and it truly is not actually important. That it was just a stray detail that we fixated on.
Yeah.
So what Blades does, and the entire system is actually called Forged in the Dark, but Blades in the Dark was the first game to like get popular in this. So I generally just refer to it as Blades. What Blades does is it puts the party in a situation and says, figure it out.
Oh.
And through flashbacks is this mechanic where you go during the heist, you say, I want to have a flashback to when I planned for this.
Oh. Okay.
When I planned for this situation. Mm-hmm. Or I want to say, I brought in a lockpicking kit for this specific situation. So the concept of load there is you have your inventory space, right? And you don't decide what you're bringing in before you start the heist.
Mm-hmm.
You decide in the heat of the moment, like, oh, I need a lockpicking kit and I have a bit of space left in my bag. I'm going to will this lockpick into existence.
Sure.
But you do have to declare at the beginning of a heist if you have light load, heavy load.
You declare your limit. Like the size of your bag.
I'm assuming that I'm going to be have a huge bag of things
and look suspicious because of it.
Sure. But you don't necessarily know what's in your magic carpet bag until the moment when you pull something out of it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it does, I think, reduce decision paralysis a little bit outside of just, do I want to have this option to be very prepared and be able to bring 7 things with me while I'm trying to steal this crown from a museum or something?
Yeah.
Versus, do I want to only bring 3 things and be really sneaky about it and no one will know that I'm there for nefarious reasons?
But also, that whole mechanic of flashbacks is, I think, very indicative of the mechanics following the theme, because that whole structure is basically, the game is a Quentin Tarantino film.
Okay.
It's Ocean's 11.
It's Ocean's
11. Specifically, which is not Tarantino.
Okay. I was thinking like Reservoir Dogs specifically.
Reservoir Dogs, I guess, would fit too.
Yeah. So in the idea, because the whole the mechanic of a flashback is like bread and butter to a heist film, wherein you are in a situation, you have a solution, and the flashback happens as context to why that occurred.
Yeah.
So that way then Because if you think about it, like, if you saw the whole preparing of the heist, you could do that, but you would have to raise the stakes in other ways.
And they oftentimes do show you the whole preparing the heist thing, but then there will be a twist, and then they'll be like, yeah, and then they'll flashback and be like, actually, you prepared for this.
Yeah,
this was the plan the whole time.
Otherwise, you tell the joke, you give the answer to the joke, and then you tell the joke, right?
Mysteries kind of do this, too, sometimes. Yeah. Like the Knives Out movies.
Mm. Which I still need to see.
Do a very good job of this, where you're given all the clues that the people in the movie have too, but then the last scene is going through the whole setup and you see what only like the murderer saw.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see all these other hints that were present to you,
right,
and you could have figured it out theoretically, but you get the whole story at the end or piecemeal throughout, like getting the solution is sort of the payoff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting way to go about it.
Yeah, it's very much the handshake meme where it's theme, mechanics, handshake.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think Blades does a good job. And we can talk about Call of Cthulhu a little bit, too.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Hit points, like the concept of hit points in D&D or a video game, it's very nebulous.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are some games where your max HP is 100. There's some where it's 1,000. There's some where it's 10,000.
Yeah.
Whatever. But Blades in the Dark, you're not necessarily playing a character until they die. Mm. So they didn't find the need to include hit points, but they did need to track a way for them to deteriorate over time.
Okay.
So the ways you get hurt and like mechanically retain problems are called stress and trauma.
Mm. Okay.
And if you get a certain amount of stress, I think it's 9, if you get 9 stress boxes from overexerting yourself, from helping other people, or from bracing a wound and like shrugging it off and continuing on with your job.
Yeah.
If you get too many stress boxes, you gain a trauma, which is supposed to manifest. That's the word. It's supposed to manifest as some sort of mechanical disadvantage.
Okay.
And if you get too many trauma, then your character has to retire.
Yeah. Or die.
Or die.
It depends on how you want to play it out.
Sure.
Yeah. And there is a sort of HP system within that called hurt or
harm.
Harm, that's what it's called.
Mm, okay.
And there's small, medium, and large boxes for harm, and they cause different amounts of stress or trauma straight up. And
okay.
Those are little granular things within stress that can actually track the way your character deteriorates over time. And I like it a lot more than just a nebulous, I have 68 HP left.
Yeah. Well, so what's interesting about the way the Blades of the Dark works is it allows for role-playing and creativity improvisation that I think D&D tends to be more numbers-based,
mm-hmm.
especially with combat.
Yes.
Really, the way that I have been playing D&D is, like, combat's pretty tactical. You have such and such hit points.
Mm-hmm.
You roll the blah, blah, blah. You get this much damage.
D&D is a war game.
Yeah, effectively.
Yeah.
But like outside of the actual battles, you kind of get to do whatever.
Yeah.
Because the systems don't let you, they don't give you enough, they're not structured in that same way. You, like everything else outside of the battle.
They give you math to then use in your own way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But Blades in the Dark, like everything is vague enough. It gives you enough structure so that you know what's happening. But it's vague enough so that like you get to build the story as it's happening, which I think is interesting. But I also think that due to the way that Blades in the Dark is designed, it's probably only good for heists, and that's it.
It is primarily
it would be difficult to make a horror game.
Crime,
crime.
Okay,
it would be difficult to make a horror game, or if you wanted to make a dungeon delving game, it might be difficult to do that.
I think you could make it wherein like you are paranormal investigators and you're doing your job.
Okay.
And, but each like instead of a heist, you would be preparing for like a job to go in and do the exorcism or get the ghosts Ghostbuster style.
Sure.
Like, but it would, that's the thing though, is you would have to structure it the same way. You would have to have like, okay, You're gonna have a business, and you can move up your business, and each of you has your own harm and stress, and then we're gonna go into a job, and we're just gonna go in blind.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like you would have to have the core structure be the same.
Yeah, but and then it would feel weird, like the way that like Ghostbusters, they have the Oh, it's been a long time since I've seen Ghostbusters. Mark would be so disappointed. Proton packs.
Yeah.
They have the proton packs, and you know they're bringing them into the house or whatever, the library,
to
capture the ghosts. I think that, like, it would feel strange if, like, you were to go into this house and you said you have a pack of nebulous things, and then you come out there and you're like, oh, I need a vacuum a la Luigi's Mansion to suck up the ghosts.
That is actually a very good point, because, like, I mean, there's a reason why, like, criminals would pretend to be, like, exterminators, but exterminators wouldn't prep for their job like criminals.
Right.
I think that is true.
I think the cool thing about Forged in the Dark as a system, it always does have to kind of center around these scores, these heists or these hits or whatever. There are a bunch of hacks is what the tabletop community refers to as sort of like a published homebrew system that is fully using this other published game system, but making their own spin on it. There are a lot of hacks of Forged in the Dark that explore other themes, I think, but their genre is pretty much always crime.
Yeah.
Because Blades in the Dark comes with a world built within the rulebook.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be using that for my game, but it is very much inspired by Victorian era combined with horror, combined with Eldritch type stuff.
Okay.
It's very Bloodborne-y.
But you could make GTA, you could have like a GTA experience using Blades in the Dark because crime.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a sci-fi sort of space pirate theme one called Scum and Villainy.
Okay.
There's a Mad Max one called Asphalt and Trouble.
That doesn't quite work.
Yeah.
I don't like that one, that name quite as much, but, you know, it's a different, we think of it as a different genre, but it really is just a different theme.
Yeah.
There's like a Magical Girl one, I believe.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Yeah. I Magical Girl's doing crime.
Actually, Magical Girl one makes sense to me. But yeah, I think what I'm curious about is, like, would it make sense for a tabletop RPG to encompass a bunch of genres instead of just one specific thing? Because, like, D&D is fantasy, right? Blades in the Dark is heist, crime, movie stuff. But, like, what if there was a... Would it make sense to make a tabletop RPG system that could encompass a bunch of stuff? And is that good?
The answer is it has been done.
Oh, I see.
I haven't personally played it.
Okay.
But there is a game called GURPS, which stands for Generic Universal Role-Playing System. And it was made in, I think, the 80s, sort of in response to D&D being so fantasy forward.
Sure. Mm.
They wanted to make some sort of dice rolling system where they could have other genres and have it actually affix to the mechanics.
Yeah, okay.
It was also at one point, I think, called like Generic Unfinished Role Playing System.
Sure. I'm sure there was a point when it wasn't finished.
Or Giant Unfinished Role Playing System, I think. But it was GURPS, essentially. Yeah. And people just call it GURPS.
Okay.
I've never personally played it. I do want to at some point. Mm. I have a friend who has played it, and he said he's done it to great effect in non-fantasy genres. Mm. But I personally don't have experience with GURPS, so I don't feel like qualified to talk about it.
Sure.
But it does exist.
I've always wondered if there would be like a system that could do like a teen drama. Like, that would be an interesting thing to role play, right?
Actually,
Thirsty Sword Lesbians? Maybe?
Actually, shoot.
That's a real one.
Oh, okay.
That's real.
Oh, so, right.
A friend of ours ran a Halloween one-shot where we were all witches. Yeah. And it basically ended up being just catty girls having drama.
It was Mean Girls.
Okay.
We basically just, like, everything got thrown out the window. We were basically just Mean Girls, and it was the best thing ever.
Yeah.
And we all decided we wanted either, like, a Real Housewives or Drunk Girls at a Bar in the Bathroom sort of one-shot. And you said, we did it in D&D. We spec'd in D&D, and we still had, like, great effects, and then we didn't do anything that he planned. Yeah. What was the system that you suggested would be better for him?
There was another game that I was talking to our friend about for this sort of social situation. I can't think of it. If I do think of it, we'll put it in the show notes.
Oh, no. Maybe it was Blades, actually.
It might have been Blades.
Because of the flashback mechanic.
Oh,
that's right.
For flashbacks.
It was...
As the editorials, the interviews with people in a reality show.
Yes.
Have that be your flashback.
It would have been a lot better as a Blades game because you could have those.
That's a reality show. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
I think you'd have to stretch a little bit to really make it work.
Yeah.
You'd have to bend the rules, but I'm a firm believer.
You would have to have the girls in the bathroom do gay crime.
Yeah.
But it would work. And also Real Housewives, basically all crime.
Right. I'm a firm believer in you need to know the rules to be able to break them in a way that works. And I think Blades could do that. Mm-hmm. It would. I have not run enough Blades yet to try that, but I think it could. It could work as a reality TV show.
I suppose it speaks to the flexibility of some of these systems. That like you can just twist the rules a little bit, and it makes sense. Because you said you did this catty girls thing in D&D, right?
Yeah, it was D&D 5e, and we were all full of beans, and it was fantastic. Yeah.
Did it make sense for that to be done in D&D? Like, did you use D&D systems for that to have worked?
Yes. Okay. So D&D has a decent set of mechanics around social interactions.
Yeah.
You have a number of skills that you can roll for these things.
And here's the thing. The premise we were given for the one shot was we were put in a situation where we were going to be basically at like a craft fair or like an art festival for the season. And we were tasked to...
We were all witches.
We were all witches. Right. And essentially we needed to like play to the crowd and get the crowd interested in witchcraft. Like think school fair, but it's a cultural festival.
Yeah.
So we really did stat ourselves out. There is a homebrewed witch class made by Brennan Lee Mulligan, who runs Dimension 20, which is a very popular tabletop RPG show.
Okay.
And for his other podcast, Worlds Beyond Number, one of the characters plays a fully homebrewed witch subclass. Mm-hmm. Most of the time in base D&D, if someone wants to be a witch, they have to be a druid because it's the closest thing to nature magic.
Yeah.
Or you have to be like a really specialized wizard or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's this homebrewed witch class, and there were four players interested, and there are four published subclasses.
So each of us were tasked to choose one of our subclasses and choose a different subclass and play those.
I see.
And but because we were, the premise was that we were going to have to talk and convince people and like pander to people and stuff like that, we spec'd our characters and got our spells with a mix of combat, but a lot, we had full expectations that we were going to need those sort of social skills spells as well, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Like some of us were craftspeople. I played a very old soup witch that didn't speak a lot of English.
Okay.
So I just made soup. And yeah, like you played a wicked witch.
I played a wicked witch who had been ousted from my coven because I broke up with my girlfriend.
Who was a witch of heart and is a matchmaker. And they cursed each other.
Oh.
So we played bitter exes.
It was glorious.
It was very fun.
But like
and we were the two most masculine people in the room. And we were both women being catty exes.
But like full old grandma, they started slinging spells at each other. I counterspelled them both. I was like, no.
It was very
No, no, we're not doing this.
Oh, you're going to eat soup.
There was a lot of room for that game in D&D.
Yeah.
Especially because our DM, Nathaniel, he intended to end this with a couple of fights.
Sure.
And we wound up only getting to one because we had so much fun with the social aspect of it.
Yeah. So, oh, well, I guess that speaks to part of the way that D&D has expanded and all of these other RPGs has expanded is that, like, because they're so, you can watch them, you can watch the people doing them, and you can, and people talk about their experiences and stuff online and socially and things like that.
Yeah.
It allows for players to feel more agency in developing the system to work for whatever it is they want to do.
Yeah.
Well, because like the possibility space seems more broad. Like when you saw in an 80s movie or whatever, somebody playing D&D, they were nerds and they were just playing, they were just rolling to fight dragons in a cavern.
It's what they show in Stranger Things season one.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's what people imagine when they talk about Dungeons & Dragons, but because Dungeons & Dragons has been around for so long and so many people have been doing it, and because now you can see other people doing it, things like that, I think that the idea and possibility space of all of these tabletop RPGs has expanded in a way that I think is cool.
I do also want to give a couple shout-outs and maybe open your own mind, because you can use different systems within the same campaign for different thematic and mechanic effect.
Yeah.
Like, use the right tool for the job. There's nothing necessarily saying that, so long as your party is fine with it, you can't bring in another tool.
Sure.
So in our campaign, we did one session that was a game of dialect.
Mm.
Because we had discovered that humans existed and we discovered that Common was a language that existed because all our characters spoke Elvish as the like lingua franca or the Common.
Yeah.
And so we played a game of dialect, essentially, one, learning about how humans and Common were ousted from our city state.
Yeah.
And also developing the language that we have just discovered, like essentially kind of going through the historical linguistic history of Common from the time, like from when humans got ousted to now, quote unquote.
Yeah, yeah.
Dungeons and Daddies, not a BDSM podcast, they played a session as their characters' grandfathers, and they played that session in D&D 1.
Oh,
first edition.
That's
first edition D&D. Okay. They played a session of that as their grandfathers.
They had to learn Thaco.
One of them didn't have to, necessarily, because he played it once as a kid, but he was like 3 or 5 or whatever.
Okay, that's fun.
But there's also the Adventure Zone. You know, used, what was the system? I think it's called
A Quiet Year.
A Quiet Year, essentially.
It's a world building game.
World build their campaign, the Adventure Zone Aethersea.
Yeah, okay.
There are ways that you could maybe, if you wanted to have kind of that heist moment or have it, thematically you needed some horror, you needed something supernatural or eldritch, you could basically say, hey, for these sessions, we're going to play this system to get that effect and to use that tool to its strongest effect. It's also kind of cool because then you don't have to try and fit a square into a circle.
Right.
You're just, you're bringing in a circle for a little bit.
Okay.
And I think that's really cool. Yeah. I personally have always, I've really enjoyed when that has been brought to the table, both as a listener or a watcher and also just as a player. Yeah. That was one of the most cool moments.
So I have experience with this actually. So we, Mark and I and a bunch of other people, used to play Star Trek Adventures, which is like the Star Trek tabletop RPG. And we were using that system for a while, but I didn't like the character that I was playing as. Mm-hmm. And so like I talked with Mark and I was like, I want to play this new character now. And what Mark ended up doing was he created a whole mystery system so that like I ended up playing sort of like Mystery on the Orient Express sort of thing.
Nice.
And he'd like developed a whole new system for that. And I know he's talked about like wanting to put it in other things because like he thought it was really good. And I thought it was really good too. But like for like one session, we played a whole different thing and everybody played different characters that they ever played because like they were part of the mystery. And I was playing a new character. So this is a new character for me. But I thought that was really interesting. It was a good way to introduce this character. And it all kind of takes place in the flashback. I'm supposed to be the pilot.
Yeah.
And I like crash the ship or crash the,
train?
Not the
pod racer?
Not the pod racer.
Oh, that's Star Wars. Ships. Sorry. That's not Star Trek.
Wow, Ian.
I'm so sorry.
Canceled.
Oh, God.
It's fine.
I can't come back, can I?
But anyway.
My parents would be disappointed too, honestly.
I'm gonna call your mom on you.
Yeah.
But like I crashed the thing and then like I was like I explained I was there was like a flashback to explain why this all happened. And I thought that was like really interesting. So like yeah, you definitely can pull in other things to like create an experience that is unique for your campaign.
Yeah.
That makes sense for it. It, like you know, it's all I like the idea of it. I think it's important for it to feel holistic in that way because then the players will be able to experience that. Like, I love the idea that, like, in order for you to play as your grandparents, you play as an older Dungeons and Dragons edition. That's so clever. I love
think
that.
It works really well, too, where if you are in a situation where your characters would be out of their element to play by a literal different rule set.
Yeah.
Because they, as
very
people, are playing by different rules.
Yeah, yeah. That's really good.
Oh,
I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about dice?
I do want to talk about dice. So, quick explanation of dice terminology. Whenever we say D4, D6, basically D number, the D stands for dice or die, and the number is reference to the number of sides that die has. So if you go into your favorite Boggle set or whatever, and you pull out one of those 6-sided dice, what do you think of as a standard die, you know, play craps or whatever, that's a D6. D&D, which we've talked about a lot, we'll continue to talk about, has a standard set of polyhedral dice. So there's a D4, D6, D8, D10, D100, which is like a D10, but it has two digits instead of one, and D20. The D20 is the one you see everywhere.
And D12.
And D12, one of my favorites. Sorry, D12.
Yeah.
those are your core dice, and you know that's where you have your probability set. So a d4, it is a 1 in 4 chance that you'll roll a 4.
Yeah.
Or a 2 in 4 chance or a 1 in 2 chance that you'll roll above a 2.
Mm-hmm.
So the culture around dice. We love our math rocks. We love hoarding them.
Yep.
I'm actually not that much of a dice goblin, honestly. I like to get single dice, and I'm very choosy. We have friends who have literal, like, just they have shelves to organize their dice sets, and they choose like three dice sets per session to represent what they think that
Like
people,
that's cool.
People will get like a new set of dice for a new character oftentimes, and maybe they'll do it right at the start of a campaign, maybe they'll do it towards the end of a campaign, but yeah, people really collect a lot of dice.
They'll get dice for specific spells, so like a fireball spell, they'll get like very like
eight
a
d6.
Set, they'll get 8d6 that are fiery themed, so that way whenever they need to throw a fireball, they have that like handful
of
dice.
Is some of that like a superstition kind of thing?
Yes.
100%.
Oh, all right.
100%
yep. Superstition. It's like baseball players with all of their gum chewing and the superstition things that
you're
they
like
do.
The underwear.
Okay. All right. Well,
there's a lot about dice.
Yeah.
What I want to talk about is how it relates, how the act of rolling dice relates to the TTRPG and how it kind of works.
Okay.
So it's rolling dice is a part of many, if not most, TTRPGs. We have mentioned a lot already. And what you want from the dice and how you read the dice after you've rolled them is a core premise of the mechanic that like fundamentally shapes the game.
Sure, right.
So for example, with D&D, you always want to roll high.
Yeah.
Right? Like there are very rare situations, and they're rare and very powerful when you are desperate to roll low. So for example, like if one of your characters is under a compulsion spell of some sort and they are attacking your friend, you want them to roll low because you don't want them to hit you.
Right.
Hit that friend, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But almost always you want to roll high.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting in Call of Cthulhu is that success is different depending on the context.
Oh, okay.
In some way, in some scenarios, you need to roll low to be successful, and in others, you need to roll high.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you want to successfully open up a lock, you may need to roll a high roll.
Yeah.
But if you are staring into the void and you know that it is staring back at you and you realize that something in the void is staring back at you,
mm-hmm.
it's actually better to roll low because you don't want to understand what is happening.
Sure.
There's a certain safety in ignorance.
Yeah.
Where like the intelligence that lets you decipher a map to get where you're going is the same intelligence that if you are encountering an eldritch being could lead you into madness or just mental dissolution.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So I guess and the reason why this works is because you set your limits based off of the stats of your character, at least in D&D, right? For instance, if you're being mind controlled, and you're attacking your ally and you don't want to actually damage them, a high strength would be disadvantageous because you would have a higher likelihood of actually hitting them, right?
Well, what you would, it's specifically, you wouldn't want to roll high in your D20.
Yes.
Because if you have a high strength bonus, then your chances of hitting them is a lot higher.
Right.
You want to roll low because you want to negate your advantage as much as possible.
Yeah, but
right?
Specifically that's due to the stats applying,
yes.
Right? Like if it was just, if everybody just had zeros on all of the things and you were just rolling and you had a 50% chance to hit, if you rolled high versus if you rolled low,
it would not be as dire.
Yeah.
It would not be as dire.
And that distinction wouldn't be as important. Like,
yeah.
I don't fully understand how Call of Duty works, but like if you have a high intelligence, you're more likely to understand things, right? So if you have a high intelligence and you're doing something that would cause you to go mad by understanding it, which to me makes sense for Eldritch Horror stuff,
sure.
That changes the context of your dice roll.
Yeah.
I think that is all dependent on the system to apply that context.
I guess is what I'm trying to understand. I think the thing about D&D in general is that you always you're always going up.
Yeah.
You're always increasing level. You always want to roll high.
Yes.
Even when you get down to low hit points, you can get healed back up to full. And like, if you want to add evidence of that injury or near-death experience, you have to narratively add it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Call of Cthulhu, you have a constant sense of every ability as a double-edged sword.
Okay.
And so in that sense, like how you, what sort, when you hold it in your hand, hold the dice in your hand, mm-hmm. and you go, I need to roll this.
Yeah.
The number that you think of, or even the idea of I need to roll high or I need to roll low, that is like that direness is literally a different, like you have a different thing you're wanting, a sure. different number you're wanting.
It causes a different feel. From yeah. the dice. Yeah, yeah. yeah. That
or
makes
you're
sense.
Like, you're trying to will the dice to do different things to the same effect.
Right. Whereas ultimately, these are just numbers, right? Like, if you roll a die and it becomes a 20, that has significance in D&D because D&D has applied significance to it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just a number. I'm not arguing against any of this. I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think
also
that, like,
this, kind of funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The cultural significance of a natural 20 mm-hmm. in D&D. Is largely homebrewed.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
The crits yeah. are homebrewed, I believe.
So a natural 20 is only a critical hit / auto success in combat.
Oh.
Rules as written.
Oh.
Almost nobody follows this.
Yeah, yeah.
Almost everybody, maybe not almost everybody, a lot of people will allow a natural 20 to be an auto success or a
success plus.
An abnormally good success
yeah.
on a nat 20. For any skill check. But rules
crit fails?
Crit fails are not a real mechanic either.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
At all.
No,
wow.
not at all. There are homebrewed, like, critical mishaps in combat mm-hmm. on a nat 1 where you, like, stab yourself, which I really dislike
yeah,
those.
Silly.
yeah, you're not actually... I think for misfiring and yeah. firearms and those kind of homebrews, that kind of works.
Yeah, yeah.
I like items that also... specifically have something dumb that happens yes. when you crit fail.
Yes, there are magic items that have an exceptionally bad circumstance if you roll a 1, especially a 1 on a D100.
Oh, yeah.
But no, in standard rules as written D&D, a 1 and a 20 don't mean anything outside of a 20 being a critical hit, a yeah. critical hit in combat.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So that has,
sorry to interject there.
Well, that has cultural significance.
Yes. It was,
that's mm-hmm. the reason why all of that stuff is because mm-hmm. like people just wanted 20s to be something.
Yeah.
And they made it.
It's very funny to me too, because the massive success of D&D right now,
yeah.
it can be attributed to a handful of things. Mm-hmm. Stranger Things did bring it to the forefront of people's minds
yeah.
when it came out, mm-hmm. but also actual play programs like Critical Role.
Mm-hmm.
Critical Role, Matt Mercer, the DM of that, does not use auto success on a nat 20.
Mm.
He doesn't.
Oh.
And you'll notice this. There's a season where he guest DMs for Dimension 20,
yeah.
which is a thing that is run by Brennan Lee Mulligan, who I mm-hmm. mentioned earlier. Brennan allows auto success on a 20.
Mm-hmm.
Mercer doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And when there are natural 20s rolled in his guest season, you can clock him saying, and what does that add up to?
Yeah.
Oh.
Whenever someone gets a nat 20.
Right.
And he'll say, okay, what's the total? And they'll say, you know, 26 or whatever.
Yeah.
And that almost always will be a success, too.
Huh.
But he does not follow that homebrew rule.
Yeah.
Despite being probably the most popular and well-known dungeon master.
Yeah. yeah.
That's fascinating. It's really all about the context.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is fully cultural. Like, so many tables adopted that rule that people just think it is the rule.
Well, yeah. I think some of it's also that, like, the thing that's brilliant about tabletop RPGs that use dice or some form of or anything that is has randomness, like the Dread system, you pull Jenga tiles and oh. you know that has some skill, but it's also
Dread is so funny. I love Dread so much.
Dread is great for horror games, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Very good for that because everything could just literally fall down
yeah,
in Jenga's front of you.
Scary.
Yeah.
yeah. Jenga is intense.
Those are really good because essentially the beauty of these sorts of systems is that you're playing pretend, but you have a infallible third party to tell you whether or not you succeed. Mm. It is not like when you're a kid and you're playing pretend and you're like, I pull my gun on you. Well, I have a laser blaster. Well, I have a super strong mirror shield that reflects your laser
yeah,
blaster.
Yeah, it's not.
Well, that's counterspell.
I have an elephant that eats your laser because its stomach is made of titanium. Yeah. You know,
no, you've got
that's
a
wild shape.
go away.
Sorry.
You are beholden to the roles,
right.
And I think
100%.
Especially in a system like D&D where you only get more powerful until
yeah.
you've like touched God / replace God,
mm-hmm.
You need to be able to still be humbled because there are
yeah.
abilities that mean that you literally can't crit fail or get lower than a 10.
Right.
But also there are so many scenarios where it's like, okay, you add 8 to this roll by default. And if so, if you roll a 1 and you still make a 50-50 shot, well, then the game's not fun without consequences. You need something very powerful both ways.
It's actually really fascinating that that the dice tend to be rigid in that way.
Yeah.
Like they force the player to adapt to situations that they maybe didn't want.
Yeah.
In a way that if you're doing make believe Calvin Ball, you can just make whatever the heck you want it up.
Yeah.
And that would be, you know, the game, and that game wouldn't be very fun because like anything could happen.
Yeah. It makes you feel the consequences of playing Calvin Ball.
Yes.
And I think very rarely does it make you stop playing Calvin Ball.
Yeah.
It's just that you know and really want it to work.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about so say that, like, okay, we roll the dice.
Yeah.
Then the question is, what do you do with the numbers that are on the dice?
Yeah, exactly.
So there's adding the values versus taking the highest number rolled. So, for example, let's say D&D, you roll 3d6s or 3 6-sided dice for damage. You want all of the dice to be as high as possible because that's going to give you more damage because you're adding them together.
Okay, yeah.
In Blades in the Dark, which is a d6 system, so you only roll d6s.
Oh.
You roll the dice. You want them to be sixes because you take the highest die that you rolled, and that dictates whether or not you're successful.
Ah. Yeah. So you can upgrade how many dice you roll for that skill.
I see.
But you do not ever add like a flat number to it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be so good at something that you roll 4d6 every time you try to do it, but you could still roll 4 ones.
Yeah, and when you think about
it, that doesn't count as a 4. It counts as a 1.
Right.
You're still holding 3d6 in your hand. You're still wanting 6s, which is a 1 out of 6 chance 3 times.
Yeah.
And you are still wanting them as many of them to be as 6s as possible.
Yeah.
But it is different because those 1 out of 6 chances are used in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's more like the odds of something being successful versus
intensity of success.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, because if you're rolling a spell in D&D that does 3d6 damage, you roll 6-1-1, you're doing 8 out of a possible 18.
Yeah.
But a 6-1-1 in Blades in the Dark is a full success.
Right.
Because you got a 6.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that changes the context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the system created that context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really, I hadn't really thought about it in that way, but like, the system's developing this context so that the dice number have impact in creating a system that allows for, like, I can imagine there being a system where, like, you want to roll a 3 specifically on a 6-sided die.
Yeah.
Like, how, in the player recognizing that and, like, making that an important aspect of their play somehow would be really interesting.
And I think, like, that's also where a lot of, you know, the superstition, you want a specific outcome for success. And it's like, well, what are you wishing the dice to do? What are you trying to manifest?
You grab your special D6 to manifest that.
Right. Because ultimately all of these games they're literally role-playing games.
Right.
And so, like, you are embodying some, an experience. You're trying to create that experience and you want experiences to happen. But the system creates experiences that might not align with what you want, but will still be exciting.
Yes. Yeah.
And then even further, with dice, you can play with probability and averages.
Yeah.
So there is a difference between rolling, in the feeling of rolling 2d6s, which is 2 1-out-of-6 chances, versus 1d12.
Yeah.
If you get a 6-6 or if you get a 12, that's still 12 total.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels different because the odds are different.
Yeah.
Like, you are more likely to roll a lower number on a d12, but also, you know, if you get a 12, it's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, especially with when you think about the whole polyhedral set. So a d4 has low numbers. It's just 1, 2, 3, 4.
Right.
But it has the highest chance to crit.
That's true.
It has a 1 in 4 chance to get a 4 versus a 1 in 20 chance to get a 20, which is a really interesting fact that is, like, really taking advantage on systems like kids on bikes and the variants of that, like kids on brooms.
Okay.
And in turn, the system based on kids on bikes, also by Brennan Lee Mulligan, he's made a lot of systems and additions and things, so he gets talked about a lot.
Yeah.
It never stopped blowing up.
Okay.
Because in kids on bikes, you essentially, instead of having stats that you add, you assign which die relates to your skill in something. So say I'm not very social, I would say, like, my social skills are D4, but if I'm very, like, tools minded, then my ability to use tools could be the d12.
Okay.
And if I roll the highest number on that die, I can roll again and keep adding.
I've seen people talk about it, kind of referring to it as beginner's luck, essentially manifesting in dice. So the stats in Kids on Bikes are fight, flight, brains, brawn, charm, and grit.
Okay.
And say you are not a very charming person. You're just learning how to talk with people. Mm-hmm. You put a D4 as your die for that skill. But it means you're going to accidentally say the right thing a lot. Because you have a really good chance to roll a 4, which means then you get to roll again.
Yeah. Okay.
And if you roll another 4, you get to roll again.
Yeah. But as you become more skilled at something, you're more consistently skilled at it, but your chances of going above and beyond become a lot lower.
I'm trying to understand the odds of you rolling like a 12. I guess it depends on like the success level. What like a success level for Kids on Bikes? If you wanted to succeed, would it be like a 3?
I think it depends on the situation. So like if you're the antisocial or the not very social person and you're at a cocktail party,
sure.
The DM might say, "Hey, you need to roll a 10."
Oh, okay.
In which case you really need to blow up you really need to roll crit and then roll another crit and then get at least a 2.
Sure.
But you have a higher chance of that happening than say like if you have if your social skills are at a 12.
Yeah.
You need to roll a 10, 11, or 12.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
You don't have to make perfect rolls 3 times. Yeah, yeah, okay.
But
yeah.
Also, you're more likely to get the low-level stuff consistently good.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, that's a difficult thing about GMing is that you need to determine how difficult something is for your players to actually roll on. Mm-hmm. And it can be contextual for the player's character itself. Say, you know your way around a toolkit, so for you to repair this engine block is not going to be very difficult.
Yeah.
So we'll call it a difficulty of 10 when you have a D20 as your tinker's check, whatever
right,
that is.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, the social situation being the opposite, a 10 is very difficult to achieve if that person just has a D4 mm-hmm. in charm.
Yeah, okay. Which is why your GMs, I mean, you had all of our core stats.
I had a cheat sheet.
You had a cheat sheet of all of our stats behind your DM screen with mm-hmm. like our AC or our armor class or how easy it is to hit us and our baseline, like what we add to things. So that way you mm-hmm. wouldn't constantly be throwing social situations at our bard. You'd be throwing them at me, character who is, not very socially skilled. But just kind of cute, so everyone just, like, lets it slide.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Charisma's a funny skill in D&D.
Yeah. It's
weird.
Or a funny ability, I guess.
I tried to make charisma a dump stat, and then I chose to play a satyr. And rules as written, satyrs are very charismatic. And I'm like, oops. Well, I guess everyone just kind of likes Henley. And it's like, whatever, it's just Henley.
Just a little guy.
Just a little guy.
That I suppose dice are the only things that, like, all players do not control.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. But are there systems that forego dice completely and they just
Dread.
Do their own thing?
Yeah, Dread.
Oh, right, Dread with Jink.
Dialect.
Okay.
Is cards based.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
There are many tabletop games need a way to introduce random chance.
Yes.
Oh,
in order for it to be a game.
Right.
The Brennan Lee Mulligan came up with the Dadlands, and what they do is they have
they play cornhole.
Yeah, they play cornhole, but the way that they choose if something is successful or not, they have like a little fanny pack with white and black rocks.
Oh, okay.
And so they have to draw a certain number and they need a certain number of those rocks to be
sure.
either white or black, depending on if it's a situation where they're using their dad skills or the other stat. I can't remember either. So in that sense, it is still like the chance is what is the contents of their fanny pack and how many they're pulling from.
That's effectively how Robossum works too.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Fails kind mm-hmm. of roles. I like the way that you phrase it, Ian, in that like these games can't be games unless there's some form of chance, because otherwise that's just improv comedy. That's not
I think
oftentimes what people are signing up for.
There are certainly games that exist that don't need to use random chance, but they are generally harder to get into, I would think. And I have not played those.
Yeah. And like I said, I think it just really, it changes it from, it's still play, but it changes mm-hmm. it from a game, I think, in a way that I think affects a lot of how people would approach it.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And very much, you know, as a final word, you know, mm-hmm. what do you want to leave to chance versus what do you want to speak into being, or what aspect do you want to leave to chance?
Sure.
That is something that whether you are playing as a system rules is written, you are modifying it or kind of homebrewing some things or bending the rules, or if you are completely making your own system, that's where you need to think about mechanically what is the effect you want, and therefore what forms of chance and how do you read the tools of chance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also the amount of granularity you will want from those that effect. Because, like, you know, you can do everything with a D4. But that will affect how successful or unsuccessful you are.
I think there's also, because dice are used in some cases to just decide on something. My favorite example in D&D is the Wild Magic table.
Okay.
Oh, I want to play Wild Magic so bad. Oh,
there's a sorcerer called a Wild Magic Sorcerer, where anytime they cast a spell, there is a chance that that a random magical effect happens.
Yeah.
And it is probably the most commonly used D100 in D&D.
Yeah.
Because there is a table with 100 choices, or maybe it's 50 choices, and each thing has two assigned numbers. I can't recall. But people have made 100 entry tables for Wild Magic. Yeah.
Everything from, like, you suddenly turn into a potted plant to you cast Fireball immediately.
Yeah, centered on yourself.
Yeah, the fifth Baldur's Gate 3 campaign we went through, I played as a Wild Magic Sorcerer. And also a Wild Magic Barbarian.
Oh,
so I just wanted all the Wild
Magic. I love
Magic.
That sounds
wild
fun.
Magic. I statted Karlach as a Wild Magic Barbarian.
Oh, yeah. Every time.
It's so fun.
I need to finish
great.
The game.
But yeah, I think that's really interesting. The way that, like, what dice you're using, in determining what, if you're like building a system, for homebrew things just to add on to D&D or what have you, you want to make sure that, like, you pick something. If you're using dice, you want to make sure that is something that is interesting for players to not have within their control.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And for you as the DM, assuming you're DMing it, to not have that in control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you want to make, because I know that, like, there's talk about, like, sometimes DMs will fudge the dice rolls to get whatever they want because, mm-hmm. like, they're the only ones who see whatever rolls they get.
Yeah.
I highly advise against doing that.
Okay.
I will say, because if your players ever find out that you fudge a roll, they will never trust the outcome ever again.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I recommend just not doing it from the get go.
Sure. Sure.
Fudge the hit points that were left. Don't fudge the roll that you got.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you could just add on.
Yeah.
After.
Yeah. I'm not saying
you're not gonna see the help.
I'm not saying people don't do it. People definitely do it.
Yeah.
I just.
And I don't even necessarily. I'm not even saying that it's wrong because, like, they're trying to 100%. Make it an engaging story.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just get you're rolling ones every time.
And the dice don't cooperate.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like, you know.
That's the thing is, I think, because by playing in this game of chance, playing your role as an agent of this chance, trying to modify it,
yeah.
You are also going into a beautiful contract that the dice will tell their story.
Yes.
Yeah.
And sometimes you roll nat ones and then you have the agency and power to decide what does that mean for your character.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of failing forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think failure, many people have said this, I think failure is a more interesting narrative concept than success
mm-hmm.
almost all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And being really good and, like, comfortable with your character in D&D or in any tabletop game, being comfortable with figuring out who they are and how they would react to failure, I think, is very cool narrative work.
Yeah.
And good character work.
Right.
And that goes beyond game design.
Yeah.
I think entirely. But there are ways to sort of make failure interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you want to do this in video games too. It's the same thing with any game. Like,
yeah.
You don't want, if a player drops off of the game because they failed in it at some point,
yeah.
Then, like, I mean, the game is too hard, or there's something that's not working.
I feel like the first Hades is very good.
Oh, I was just going to say that, because failure gives you an opportunity. The genius of Hades is that when you fail a run, you can go to the house and do things.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's inherent to your success in the game.
And your progress.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a core part of it, and I think that's important. So, like, that is an aspect that, like, you as a DM needs to recognize, is that, like, if your dice aren't cooperating, quote unquote, with what you want, then, like, you can change what that dice means. I like the way you phrased it, Lydia, in that, like, just because you rolled a one doesn't mean that you literally failed. It could mean that, like, something happened that gives you a success in a way that you did not want or initially come up with. But, like, you still need to be creative enough to come up with that. The dice don't, they're not that rigid.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
that
way.
Yeah. Well, you now have listened to Ian.
Mm-hmm.
It is also the beginning of a brand new year.
Woo. Yes, right. And it's a brand new year for you to tell me why I'm wrong.
And it's a brand new year for you to tell me what I should do and what I should keep doing, because I've been doing this for a year and I don't know what I'm doing.
And we can show Ian these things and he could be like, yeah, I agree with that. Or no, actually, Stephen was completely wrong about this. You know?
Yeah, I feel like I should be able to criticize you for inviting me here.
Yes, so you could go to nicegames.club/feedback and drop how you feel about the show in there so that we can read it and improve the show.
Help us fail forward. Roll our ones.
Hey.
And we'll see what happens.
Nice, nice.
Is the star system a D10 then? If you get, you know, 4.5 on it, you rolled a 9 out of 10. are the viewers, are the listeners random chance?
Oh, I don't know. Go to nicegames.club/feedback and let us know.
All right, act three, flexibility.
Yes. So, Ian, you had brought up the idea of, like, rules light versus crunchy rules and when you're supposed to use those. And I guess the way that I was imagining it is, like, D&D is very rigid with respect to combat. Mm-hmm. It gives you all the numbers about how everything is supposed to work.
It gives you an action economy.
Yes, an action economy.
It is literally called an economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whereas outside of actual combat, D&D is much more flexible and rules light. It has a broad lore in how everything is supposed to work, but like you as the party can determine how you actually want to go about that aspect of it.
Right.
I would argue it's rules light because there's so much lore that most people don't pay attention to.
I agree. I think non-combat parts of D&D are pretty rules light.
Yeah.
Most people, when they are describing D&D to somebody, they say there's three pillars: there's combat, social, and exploration.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that combat is the load-bearing wall. It's the piece of drywall that has the stud in it.
Right.
And then exploration and social are like decorative pillars that you didn't actually need for your house.
Sure.
Which one is the punch in the drywall that didn't have a stud?
That's definitely exploration. exploration in 5th edition is bad.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I shouldn't say bad. It's,
you could say bad.
It's kind of bad.
Your show right now.
I think Wizards of the Coast,
yeah,
the publishers of D&D,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
they leave a lot to the DM to design for exploration.
Sure, okay.
I think social has enough abilities already. There's like 18 skills in D&D,
yeah.
And a lot of the social situations get handled with persuasion, intimidation, or performance,
all
or
the
deception.
Charisma things, yeah.
All charisma.
Which makes sense.
Yeah. It's your bard is going to be the smooth talker almost all the time. And
yet, you have to homebrew a rule that your barbarian can use their strength stat instead of their charisma stat
for
to intimidate.
Yeah.
Because typically barbarians don't have a high charisma, but they would be very intimidating.
And,
right.
And they get often, there's a mechanic called proficiency where you will add some sort of flat bonus to certain skills. And that bonus increases as your levels go up. And oftentimes, barbarians will have proficiency in intimidation,
mm-hmm,
but they won't have a high charisma to start with.
Yeah.
So they may be starting from a -1 on these rolls, and then their proficiency at level 3 just gives them a +1, even though they're 300 pounds of solid meat wielding 2 battle axes.
Right.
You know?
Hot.
Yeah, well, that's beside the point. That's persuasion. that's persuasuasion. But no, so social situations do have a good amount of explanation, I think, in D&D, especially if you read the Dungeon Master's Guide,
mm-hmm,
which is another, there are 3 core rule books in most editions of D&D. There's the Player's Handbook, the Dungeon Master's Guide, and the Monster Manual.
Yeah.
And the Dungeon Master's Guide, I think, routinely is the most useful, especially if you have some sort of a game design brain, because that includes all of the edge cases.
Mm-hmm.
Where what if the party is trying to bribe somebody? Yeah. What if the party is trying to talk somebody down from starting a war with a neighboring country?
Sure.
They have an audience with a king or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives you sort of starting positions for your non-player character, which is just a character played by the DM, starting positions for them, and essentially negotiation tactics to get to the middle. The problem is it's all based around persuasion. It's all just one, the same role over and over.
Yeah.
Listeners will remember the nice thinking that I did when I was coming up with the memory mechanic for the one shot that I did, where and all of the players had amnesia and had and started with blank character sheets. My, in the same way that persuasion or anything that is social is based on charisma, the core premise of that was if you're going to remember something, it's always a history check. And most people don't, most classes are not in D&D, basically how, what type of fighter you are not geared or incentivized to pick intelligence, which is the, what gives you your bonus in history as a good stat. So if you want to have any form of, you know, the any form of random chance or spectrum of ability to remember something, it has to be something other than history.
Yeah.
It has to be something other than intelligence. Otherwise, you're just going to keep making pretty weak rolls.
Yeah. And so what that, I suppose what that kind of means is that oftentimes players have to convince the DM that, like, this stat that I'm rolling is relevant and not the history or intelligence or whatever thing that I needed to pick.
There is something written into the rules of D&D for that.
Okay.
It's so they have to make a distinction between abilities and skills.
Okay.
Ability are your six things that you assign points to at the start.
It's
strength, dexterity, constitution, wisdom, intelligence, and charisma.
Yeah.
But then your 18 skills, I think it's 18, they are all based off of one of those abilities. And there's a little parentheses next to it where it'll say acrobatics, parentheses, dexterity, or history, parentheses, intelligence. And in pretty much any scenario, you can try to convince your DM that, hey, I'm applying my intelligence here, but I'm thinking about something to do that is more often a wisdom stat, like nature, I think, is wisdom.
No, nature's intelligence. I think.
Insight.
Oh, no, you're thinking of survival.
I'm thinking survival.
Survival is wisdom.
Survival is wisdom. Thank you.
Well, they're certainly not intuitive.
That's true. survival is actually the best example of this because I think survival, in many cases, should be a constitution check.
Sure.
Because
that makes sense.
If you are trying to ford a river and not drown.
Yeah.
And like keep your footing. That might be constitution or dexterity.
Yeah, yeah.
But you have what you do is you roll survival and say I'm going to add my constitution to this, but because I have proficiency in survival, I can still add my proficiency from that. So I'm adding my constitution number and my survival number.
Yeah.
Oh.
So that is a rule that is written into D&D. It's not used very often. And I think it's a great tool for DMs to just know that it exists. Because there is a way to kind of account for these edge cases.
I think part of it is because D&D is so crunchy.
It gets missed a lot.
But also because the way to make it more accessible and more quick is even just the character sheets are designed as such that if you have proficiency in a skill, you fill in a little bubble and you can write down what the plus is. And the plus means your skill plus your proficiency.
Yeah.
Like, I've started actually writing my character sheets where I have, like, I indicate what numbers it is pulling from, so that way I can start learning it.
Because it might be, like, three different sources that you're getting.
Especially when it comes to, like, your armor class, because there's your speed, your natural, your ability, and then your armor and your shield,
You
have a shield.
Armor class.
But then
it's
also,
no sense to me.
If you have a spell that increases your armor class, you add that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, like, potentially four sources.
It's absurd.
And so because...
And cover.
Oh, and cover.
Cover.
But because it's so crunchy, we have UX'd our games such that we collapse all of those stats together.
Sure.
Which means that picking them apart to use them in more flexible ways as it is suggested is not as evident, and it's also not as feasible.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
I think D&D, at least 5th edition, really a lot of the time wants to be crunchy, but then they didn't design enough rules for exploration and social for it to really be crunchy.
Yeah.
So there's a thing that I kind of wanted to bring it up during Dice, but I can talk about it now, where I got this special 18-sided die that I think actually has 24 sides, but it has 18 usable sides.
Okay.
That are specifically to roll for a random encounter while you're traveling, while you're on the road, or while you're resting at a campsite.
Okay.
You need to oftentimes keep the party engaged by throwing things at them.
Yeah, you don't want to just fast travel there.
You don't want to just fast travel. It's not Skyrim. We can't just teleport to Whiterun.
Yeah.
The way like new DMs often do it is say, okay, we're just going to throw a bunch of really small combats at them because I know how to run a combat. Guess what? It's not exploration. That's combat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exploration is getting lost.
Right.
It's navigating your way to a location. It's foraging for food.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are skills that sort of allow for this, but you know, a nature check maybe is going to tell you, oh, is this food that I'm foraging, is this a poisonous mushroom? Am I familiar enough with this? But there needs to be a little bit more than just a single roll to keep people engaged.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, think about this if you've ever played Pokemon and you're wandering around in the grass and you're just trying to get from point A to point B and you have to fight a bajillion Rattatas.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're playing one of those, like an OG Final Fantasy, where you're on the overworld map and you get a random encounter.
Mm-hmm.
Those are still all combats.
Right.
It feels very different if you are in Pokemon and you are in a cave and you realize, oh, I need to move some rocks around to get to the other side.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
like
a puzzle.
That feels different because it's not just Rattata, 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 Rattata.
Right. Yeah. I think the way puzzles fit in best to D&D is often exploration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes that's in a dungeon crawl where you have a big map and, you know, one of these rooms is just like a little puzzle box.
Mm-hmm.
I still think that counts as a good exploration tool.
I think part of what gets lost with exploration is in D&D, you almost never have the sense that you're going to come back to the place where you were before.
Yeah.
Oh, it's true.
Yeah,
true.
I can't really think of any time in D&D where I've thought, okay, I'm going to come back to that. I'm going to remember that that's there and I need to come back.
Yeah.
I mean, especially like compared to something like Blueprints,
right,
which I've been playing a lot of.
You will definitely get back to things that you were in before.
Truly, you don't really do that in D&D.
No, yeah. Not really. I think you can, well,
it feels like an undertaking.
If you do a mystery, yeah. If you really carefully design a mystery,
yeah.
I think Fantasy High did it pretty well.
No, you're thinking also they did Of Mice and Murder, because that was set in a house.
Mice and Murder was a full mystery, yeah.
It was a full mystery in D&D.
But the first Fantasy High was also a mystery.
That is true.
Remember,
that
it was very much like,
and inside a house, 80s, it was 90s, the town.
Yeah, 80s, sure. 90s teen movie, and these girls disappeared and they need to figure out what happened to them.
Okay.
But part of that is because they understood the exploration. It was their town that they knew, and mm-hmm. you could feasibly take a bike or take ride a motorcycle across town in a couple minutes.
Yeah.
In like a couple hours.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to me that, like, at least with D&D, and maybe this is different in other systems, y'all could let me know, that the systems don't provide players/DMs enough guidance to allow or creativity.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
I think for
there's not enough. Oh, go ahead.
I think for flexibility.
Yes.
And therefore, it doesn't give as express permission to be creative.
Well, yeah. The game is prioritizing combat because all the stats that you get are relevant in combat.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the things, all of the spells you can do and all the actions you can do, most things are involved combat.
Mm-hmm.
And so players and DMs are prioritizing combat because the system is mostly around that idea. And that's why, like, when somebody is exploring and they just keep running into random encounters and they have to keep doing combat, that's why that happens, is because the game is encouraging that. That's why it happens in Pokemon, is because, like, the game is about combat.
Yes.
You're just fighting Rattatas or whatever. And so the game keeps throwing things at you because that's where the play is.
Yeah.
And so I think that, like, I'm assuming that other tabletop RPGs do this differently, but, like, due to that emphasis, DMs are struggling to come up. They have to do new things or different things that D&D doesn't really apply to allow for more flexibility within that system, to allow for more things to make true exploration.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's well said.
What I often wind up doing is, because D&D has fairly well-designed combat, they figured that stuff out.
Yeah.
I will wind up making more interesting combats that involve the non-combat pillars.
Okay.
My favorite combat was a murder trial.
Okay.
Oh, God.
And one of the party members was on trial for murder. unbeknownst to him, because he didn't do it.
White collar crime instead of murder trial.
Right.
Embezzlement.
And essentially what I did was, on one side of the battlefield was a judge and a jury.
Yeah, okay.
And on the other side of the battlefield were mercenaries coming in to essentially execute the prisoner.
Oh. He was, like, chained to the floor in the middle of it.
Yeah,
my goodness.
He's chained in the middle. So he is on both sides of the combat.
Yeah.
And the way that I set it up was, if you are on the court side, you cannot participate in the combat side.
Ah.
And if you're on the combat side, you cannot try to persuade the jury over there.
But both sides are acting in defense of the defendant.
Ah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So
it's murder in more ways than one, I guess.
Yes, 100%. Okay. I'm not saying it was a fair trial.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it.
Oh, no. Even better, he's the one who designed this judicial system, and he doesn't remember that he did.
Yeah, well, that's like the whole amnesia thing in our campaign.
Oh, boy.
That was a 6.5-hour session, like, the weekend before Christmas.
Yeah. Christmas stressful. 24,
we,
I believe.
We
yeah,
literally
a little over
had,
a year ago.
Like, a separate Discord DM.
Yeah, you made a war room.
Except for Ian, we had a war room where we were figuring out who's going to be on the court side, who's going to be on the defense side, what our arguments are going to be.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Who's going to have to stay close by to switch sides?
Yeah.
Because you could switch between the court and the bodily defense side.
Uh-huh.
But like, you had to actually physically cross the line.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
That was fun. And the thing I did, I think round one, is I had one of my mercenaries cast Wall of Fire at the wall.
Oh, my God.
And you were able to dispel it pretty quickly, if I remember correctly. But
my job, I held on to the one that was magic, and I grappled him, and I kept hitting him on the head with my head until he died.
Mm-hmm.
Because satyrs can hit people with their heads.
Yeah,
that's fun.
So I think designing your own stuff in D&D oftentimes has to have combat in mind.
Yeah.
I've definitely designed things that aren't combat, but the ones that wind up turning out the best, I think, involve it in some way.
And to be fair, like you said, Ian, I think that, like, people, D&D does combat well, and people like the tactics-based combat.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's not even necessarily a bad thing. It's just that, like, I think some people want D&D to apply to more things than that the system is capable for.
Yeah.
And it's why I'm switching to Blades in the Dark.
Sure.
Because there is combat in Blades, but it resolves a hell of a lot quicker.
Right. Yeah. Like, and so people who are more into the tactics-based gameplay might not enjoy Blades in the Dark as a result of that.
Yeah.
Right. It's a narrative-forward game.
Yeah.
There's also people who have done, essentially made kind of a social situations that act like combat, almost like a tete-a-tete, wherein like the person that you're talking to can take like a certain amount of hits to then be convinced to do something.
Yeah,
it's Ace Attorney, honestly.
Basically. Yeah.
It is Ace Attorney. So that is taking the idea of, if this conversation was a battle or a duel, how would, and you are using your social skills to inflict damage onto the wall that's preventing them from helping you, or their argument against helping you or whatever. The other thing that is, I think, very salient, and you talking about, you know, that where the play is, one of the things that they, I think, do mention in the books in D&D is that you don't always have to solve a situation by fighting.
Yeah.
But that's the problem, is that if you solve a situation by not fighting, you have stopped the play.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so you are less likely to come up with creative decisions unless you are put in the situation where, like, it is disadvantageous for you to fight.
Right.
And that is very much on the DM and not on the player. The player is the one who could try to just, like, back out or run away or mollify this, like, stop the situation from happening. Like, hey, wait, no, we're here to help you.
Yeah.
But that means that they're making the choice not to play.
Right. Mm-hmm. And even in the situation, like, the way that D&D works, as far as I understand.
Or I guess asterisk, not play in the way that the mechanics are make it easiest and most
it's not designed
engaging to play with.
It's not designed for the social aspects. It's designed for you to roll to get past social aspects so you could do more fights.
Yeah.
But even the way that you gain experience and do the fun things of, like, number go up, is due to combat. Like, you have to be successful in combat to get level up, yeah, right? To get experience.
Yeah.
Unless you do the, there's that other
milestone.
Yeah,
milestone. Yeah, we've thing, only ever done preference. Milestone.
I mostly run milestone.
Yeah, because I'm like, otherwise I got to fight a bunch of goblins to get to level 4. And I'm
yeah.
Like, I don't know that I want to do that.
Yeah.
It's a very funny concept where you get good at wizardry not by studying. You get good at wizardry by killing rats.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's not how that's supposed
yeah,
to work.
No.
You need to go to school.
Yes.
You dissect the rats and analyze them, and then you learn more about the rats to be better at killing them.
Yeah.
Know thy enemy. It's always rats.
Yeah, the wizards have a very high medicine check. There's also sort of the aspect of improv
yeah.
in D&D and in tabletops in general. Because it is collaborative storytelling and
yeah.
you don't really know where it's going to go, mm-hmm. the DM will often have sort of a loose plot in mind, but the other players at the table need to have a lot of input mm-hmm. in where the story goes.
And buy-in,
yeah. It's the DM's job to make sure the players actually are interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And once the players buy in, they can start inputting and changing the story and making like taking big swings to radically change the plot, perhaps.
Yeah.
So there's a concept within RPGs known as railroading, where the game master will say, no, we're doing this right now.
Oh.
We can only be here. We have to be on the rails. We can't go off the rails because I don't know what I'm doing if I'm off the rails.
Yeah.
The train cannot drive on not rails.
Right. We're not multi-track drifting. It's not the trolley problem solution.
Deja vu.
So I think there needs to be room for improv
yeah.
in these games, and honestly a lot of the social pillar winds up being who can make the DM laugh.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
because that, like, you're having candid conversations with the player as their character.
Yeah,
and if they have a good sense of who their character is, that they can start cracking in universe jokes, they're gonna get a reaction from me as a DM, but also as the character, most
mm-hmm.
likely. And it's fun.
Yeah.
It's where most of the fun is for me in RPGs.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're just hanging out with your friends telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right? And I think some games do try to emphasize that.
Yeah.
In saying we're a narrative forward game, don't think about it too hard because the story will happen as it happens.
Mm-hmm.
I like thinking about it, though. Mm. And I like thinking about all these possibilities and making up these crazy situations for my players to be in because I want to see how they'll react to
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I'm kind of curious because we've talked about improv before.
Sure,
a little
yeah.
bit. I can't remember exactly which episode, but it was a roundtable.
Mm-hmm.
Now that you've played D&D a little bit,
yes.
what was your kind of first buy-in into the, like, for your character in the world that you have, or for you as a player to start engaging with it in that way?
Well, I think the thing that I like most about D&D, honestly, is the social aspect of it. Same mm. with board games, really. Like, the reason why I like playing board games is because I'm playing with other people, and I enjoy
yeah.
playing this. I enjoy having this experience with other folks. And so, like, I think that with D&D, when I was really feeling like my character made sense, is when other people recognized aspects of my character that I did not.
Yeah.
Because of the decisions that I made.
That's
yeah.
a classic.
So, like,
yeah.
initially, my character, at least the one that I'm playing right now, she was kind of standoffish. Like, she didn't,
yeah.
she wasn't very social because, like, she's all about books. She's like, she's kind of like Lydia, actually.
What?
I didn't intend for that. But she's kind of
oh.
like, in that she likes reading and she likes learning about stuff.
Oh,
she's
yeah.
very
yeah,
excited
yeah.
about books.
I learned a thing today. Yes.
Whenever she loots a body, she's like, where are the books?
And I need to share the thing that I learned.
Yeah.
That's the key.
Well, she doesn't do that as much.
Okay.
So it's a little
different.
Do you
want some
fun Lydia.
Facts? I could give you some fun
facts. She's got so many fun facts.
I believe it. I know. but like one of the things that ended up being, as a result of that, that like some of the other players around recognized, is that because my character was
did they start looting bodies for books for you?
No.
Oh.
Not like that.
Oh, but that's a level of friendship I hope you reach.
I hope so too. That's cool. But what was interesting is that, like, because I was being kind of standoffish and focusing on books, when I was doing when I was like going off and doing things on my own, people didn't really trust me.
Yeah.
Because, like, they didn't really know who I was.
Yeah.
Sure.
And I didn't really express my character that well, partly mm-hmm. because I was still trying to figure it out. But like over time, my character, it to me, it made sense for my character to feel a little bit more comfortable expressing things. So like I'm kind of more cautious with the information that I share. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, I share information that is important, mm-hmm. That I feel like is important to the party. But otherwise, I'm just more focused on like gathering knowledge just for the sake of knowing things.
Yeah.
And that might come into conflict in the future because I got this evil book now and we'll see what this book does.
Oh, jeez.
Is it cursed?
Perhaps? It may be cursed.
What if that's what happens to overdue library books is that they get cursed.
Oh. They go bad.
Like, they go bad, yeah. They go rogue.
Oh, I like that, actually.
Well, I am a rogue, so it's...
Oh!
I like that a lot.
They go to the rogue.
Yeah, that's true. They go to the rogue.
But yeah, I think that, like, my character kind of just created itself through the play.
Yeah.
In a way that I think, like, I think other people... Like, Lydia, you've expressed this, too, like, you will plan out your character a lot and like who this character is. And it grows over time, certainly. But like, yeah, you have a lot of background understanding of who this character is and what they might decisions they might make and things like that.
Yeah.
And I am not great. I'm bad at planning things. So yeah. That's part of my problem with that. I'm better at like making sense on the fly.
Yeah. I have like not a comprehensive history, but I have like guiding principles.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, that because that's like enough structure that I feel comfortable seeing who they become as we go,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And seeing kind of who they end up being.
Yeah.
But I have something always to fall back on and always to reference if I have to make a decision and I'm not necessarily sure how they would behave.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I think, a really important distinction between video game RPGs and tabletop RPGs.
Yeah.
Because even though there are social situations in Baldur's Gate, or maybe even something like a Fallout,
sure,
kind of game,
mm-hmm,
it doesn't always have a big effect on what happens at the end of the game.
Yes.
Whereas in a tabletop game, you are deciding to make these friendships or cut these people off or make enemies, and that will affect, always will affect things later in the game because...
Right.
That character's not there anymore, or that character becomes a tag along to the party, essentially, mm-hmm, and they're way more involved in the story because of some commitment you made to them,
well,
essentially.
I think actually more so it in video games, it doesn't carry with the character.
Yeah.
In this, because I keep thinking of like, I was just thinking like, oh, Disco Elysium, it does have a lot of consequences, and there's a whole like reason that there's a tag on Steam for your decisions have consequences.
Right. Yeah, true.
Logistically, it gets you to the end. But the thing is that a lot of the things that happen changes your character fundamentally.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They are different at the end. It's not necessarily, it, like, yes,
the
ending
is
different.
Same.
Yeah.
But you, the person who ends up at the end is a very different person.
Yeah,
it's not every video game RPG. Yeah. I think it is.
But I think that it has to be programmed in very intentionally and very
detailed. It's often inherent in a tabletop game.
Yeah.
I think.
For sure.
Like the video game that I think best encapsulates it, Disco Elysium is very good, but I think Citizen Sleeper is also a very good example.
Okay.
And it's another one of these dice rolling games. You start, I think the way that one works is you roll 5d6s at the start of the day, and those are just the 5 you have to work with that day.
Okay.
Oh,
so
it's like a Divinity Wizard, but uh-huh, only Divinity Wizard.
Yeah, so if you roll, you know, 4, 4, 5, 5, 6, then you're going to have a great day.
Mm. Oof.
But if you roll 1, 1, 1, 1, 5,
oof,
you got to make that 5 count.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the ones are going to get burned on something that you probably aren't going to succeed on.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just have a bad day. You only got 2 hours of sleep.
You sing a sad song, and then you turn it around.
And then you turn it around. I think you got 2 hours of sleep is the next lyric. Yeah.
So you didn't long rest.
you only short rested.
I
think that game does a very good job of creating consequences, and there are several different endings to that game that involve different characters, different NPCs throughout the game. I need to play the second one of those. That's a tangent. But
we
have
talked about some of like a homebrew mechanic for ADHD, which is something similar, wherein like you... random, like, this, every day you get a different, like, you get proficiency in a random skill, and you also get a disadvantage in a random skill, or you get advantage in one and you get disadvantage in another. Mm. Because every day, who knows, like, you're going to be really good at something and something is just not going to work.
Yeah.
It was something akin to that. But that idea of every day is different and sometimes you're just bad at it.
Yeah.
Really, that is the beauty of tabletop games. Some days, despite all your intentions, they just don't work out.
Right. You can be in Skyrim. You can be too weak to defeat an enemy, but it doesn't mean that your character's bad at what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I think often in D&D, you know, you'll have a really high, you know, medicine score or whatever, but you can still roll that one.
Yeah.
And just, you're having a bad day. Mm-hmm. You weren't able to do it. It
just doesn't work out.
You forgot how to apply a bandage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you put it on their forehead, and that's not where the slice
is. No, their hand was cut off.
Yeah.
In fact, you shouldn't have grabbed the bandage in the first place.
No, yeah. Really, just the wrong tool for the job all around.
Yeah. That's also, I think, goes a little bit into back to how you deal with failure.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I think that you mentioned, Ian, when I ran my memory mechanic is you really liked that the way I contextualized a failed trying to recall a memory was just... because they were in the middle of the burning husk of the village. It was like, you are surrounded by smoke. You can feel the heat of the fire and you just cannot bring your mind to anything other than getting out of there.
Yeah.
Like just fully, that is not where your brain is going. Yeah. And that's why you couldn't summon a memory.
Right, right.
Not that you're not able to. It's that now is the wrong time.
Yeah.
And that resulted in me later on deciding, because I had the feeling like, oh, I'm a monk of some kind. Mm-hmm. And I needed to figure out what it was. So after that first day's battle, I decided I'm going to go back to my room at the tavern and meditate and figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
And that was my first successful memory.
Was when you were meditating. Yeah.
Was when I was meditating. Mm.
Dang, you got to bring that memory mechanic.
I know.
It was fun. It was fun to play.
I'm working on it. I really enjoyed running it. I really enjoyed making it. And I think I hope it's helpful. I think it's helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Check back on my website, see if I posted it or not.
All right.
Got to get the plug in there.
Don't sound too enthusiastic. NiceGames.club/feedback.
Yeah. Tell me that I'm wrong for not posting it quickly enough, not editing it quickly enough.
Tell Stephen that he's wrong for not telling Lydia to do it already.
Yeah.
Tell Ian to tell their wife to do the thing.
You do that already a lot.
Ian won't read the feedback, but you can try.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Discuss this episode, or others, or whatever, with your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, Ian is going to return! But that's it for this week. So until we start again, remember to...
play nice
and make nice. Sorry.
The Noom got you.
The Noom really got me.